My guest is Brian Bull. He's a public radio news reporter for KLCC in Eugene, Oregon. Brian has worked in public radio for more than 20 years, and he's the lead interviewer for the Public Radio Oral History Project. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me on, Mike. Good to talk to you again.
Our listeners are also invited to join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Brian, what's the Public Radio Oral History Project?
The Public Radio Oral History Project, wow, that is a great question to start with because it's a very encompassing project that launched in February of 2022 through the late Ken Mills, who was the editor and producer of Spark Notes. He was an industry watchdog and a radio enthusiast. And Ken just really talked to a lot of people. He loved public radio and the personalities and the innovators within the system. And he realized after talking to a lot of people, including Jay Kernis, that there were a lot of people who were really invested in the daily output of public radio, but were actually not on top of tracking their own history, their own achievements, their own history, essentially. And so after talking to Jay Kernis, who was the founding innovator behind Morning Edition, and now works at CBS Sunday Morning, by the way, Ken Mills decided that he needed to start this project so that there would be some type of repository of history and images and recordings that would help preserve the American public radio system's earliest years as we know it.
Well, it's kind of a relationship that the public has with these voices, isn't it?
It really is. You know, we talk about a lot of the innovators and the pioneers behind the scenes, and they have their role too. But, of course, the most readily sociable people that people know are through these very distinct, unique voices that people have been listening to for decades. Of course, the late Bob Edwards was a very famous voice that people tuned into for Morning Edition for a good number of years. Susan Stamberg is still around as a special correspondent, and she started back in 1975. And so she's, a half century matriarch of the whole system. In fact, she was part of what people call the founding mothers of public radio, along with Nina Totenberg, Cokie Roberts, and Linda Wertheimer. And people really feel this kinship when you hear a familiar voice like theirs reporting on the Supreme Court or just greeting them in the morning to announce the day's news and events.
Well, we actually have a short piece from the interview with Susan Stamberg. Can you give us a brief setup and we'll talk about it on the other side?
Sure. Now, when I talk to a lot of these folks about NPR and in the context of the Public Radio History Project, we talk a lot about their earliest years, the beginning formation of the NPR system as we know it. And so for Susan, it was both an exciting opportunity, but also it was breaking the glass ceiling at that time because she became the very first woman to host a national news program. But she also acknowledged that there were many people who helped her along the way. And I think that's a good setup for this clip as she talks about starting at NPR in 1971.
I never got a job in my entire life that was not decided for me by a male. So I'm certainly a feminist, but not anti-male because I'm very grateful to the men who decided I was hireable. But in the beginning, it was thrilling. It was so exciting. We were creating something that had never existed with very big ambitions. I mean, in my mind, this skinny little network was going to be, I wanted it to be the New York Times of radio. I wanted it to be that big. We had five reporters. So that was quite an imagination that I had.
Wow, that's quite a vision. That NPR would endeavor to be the New York Times of radio broadcasting. Talk about that interview.
Yeah, no, it was great. Just a quick follow-up to that, you know, in the time since Susan Stamberg was hired in 71, NPR now has, I believe, 1,000 member stations and affiliates, according to the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. So So, you know, I don't know quite how that equates to the New York Times, but it is a very extensive array of reporters and producers out there, not just from NPR itself, but through its member system. Susan Sandberg was an absolute delight to talk to. It's funny, Mike, I initially invited her, I think, about a year or so ago to be part of this project, and she politely declined. I think she was enjoying her retirement and catching up with friends and relatives and just enjoying things that did not involve being in front of a microphone all the time. But at the urging of Jay Kernis, he said, try again, try again. You know, I'm sure something will open up soon. And I kept applying, as one does in this business. And when I called her again to be part of this, I believe she had just had hip surgery or something. And so she was laid up. And so I actually had a lot of free time to dedicate talking about her early years, her early beginnings, and her fascination with radio. And it was just so cool to listen to her talk about what this was like to be the first woman to anchor a national news program, all things considered, and to kind of start from very humble beginnings. There was so much disorganization and so much uncertainty when NPR launched that, you know, I think people were always concerned about keeping the lights on and getting the report on. And oftentimes when it was live radio, that's something that people forget, is that when you tune into All Things Considered in any program in NPR, most of the time it's live radio happening in real time. And it's just through the efforts of dedicated people like Susan Sandberg that has kept this this great thing going for 55 years now.
So Brian, how did you get to be selected as lead interviewer?
So many, many years ago, I am dating myself now. Back in the late 90s, I started off as a news director for South Dakota Public Radio, and I had coordinated and produced a documentary called Dakota Heroes, which was about South Dakota's role or connections to World War II with my team of reporters there in Vermilion, South Dakota. And it did very well. We won a regional and then a national Murrow Award that I think picked up a lot of people's ears because we were operating out of this little dusty radio station in, again, the farthest southeast corner of South Dakota. And then I went on to produce more documentaries because I kind of feel I had a flair for it. And one of those was about one of the FBI's most wanted fugitives, Vern Miller, and his role in the Kansas City Massacre. He was a World War I hero and sheriff turned hitman and bootlegger. And it's just one, I think just the fact that Ken and I had this wavelength, if you will, of public radio geekiness and enthusiasm that we eventually just kind of drifted into each other's orbits. And so he helped me distribute and promote the documentaries that I was working on, and we just kind of stayed in touch. And even though we had been out of touch for roughly a decade, he reached out to me in 2021, 2022 to say, hey, Brian, I need someone to help me do these interviews. I need someone to help me do some research. And are you willing to be that partner? And after about 5 minutes reflection and contemplation, I said, sure, because I just knew Ken was a real passionate person who really wants to make this happen. So I think when it launched in February of 2022, Ken and I quickly organized who we were going to talk to. Excuse me. Who we're going to talk to, where we saw the scope of the project going. And you know, we just, I think, had a real understanding of what it took to really make this project happen. Regrettably, Ken died from health complications. He had some issues with his health, including cancer, and he passed away in August of 2023. So before he passed, I agreed to inherit and take over the Public Radio Oral History Project. And so here we are right now. Everything I do is in memory of Ken, and I hope that he's watching over my shoulders at this day and making sure that these interviews happen to spec.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job. My guest is Brian Bull. He's a public radio news reporter for KLCC in Eugene, and he's the lead interviewer for the Public Radio Oral History Project. So, Brian, we have another excerpt from your interviews, this one with Bill Semmering. Can you set it up for us?
Sure. Bill Semmering was one of the earliest innovators behind NPR. I believe he was part of a small group of I believe it was part of a board of directors that was made up of station operators, managers of, I believe, roughly 9 or 10 educational radio stations across the United States. And when NPR began being formed, he was asked by the board to write these purposes for NPR. So this is way back in 1969, roughly about a year before NPR became formally incorporated. But he wanted there to be guiding principles. And so this was kind of part of the purposes, the so-called purposes that he wrote for NPR back in 1969, which he felt were pretty essential to guiding this fledgling organization to its best potential.
National Public Radio will serve the individual. It will promote personal growth. It will regard the individual differences with respect and joy rather than derision and hate. It will celebrate the human experience as infinitely varied rather than vacuous and banal. It will encourage a sense of active, constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness. The total service should be trustworthy, enhance intellectual development, expand knowledge, deepen oral aesthetic enjoyment, increase the pleasure of living in a pluralistic society, and result in a service to listeners which makes them more responsive, informed human beings, and intelligent, responsible citizens of their communities and the world.
I love those principles. Tell me about Bill.
It gives me chills, and I think that those principles are very much in need today when I look at the broader media landscape.
Tell me about your experience with him.
With Kim?
Tell me about your experience with Bill. Did you get a chance to spend any time?
Oh, with Bill. You know, this was done remotely. We got to do the interview via Zoom. We kind of had a little bit of an elaborate setup, which we try to replicate with each interview. I would talk to them via Zoom because it allowed me to see the people that I was interviewing. But we also did a studio recording, and so Bill had a laptop in WHYY there in Philadelphia, which is familiar to many NPR listeners for being the home of Fresh Air of Terry Gross. Bill was set up in the studio, and he brought his notes and his paperwork, and we talked for, I believe, about an hour and a half about the earliest days of NPR. And I found him to be so considerate and so genuine and so passionate to this day. I don't remember how old he is right now. You know, he's showing a little bit of his age in that clip, but I believe he's in his late 80s or early 90s, and he still has such a strong conscience, a strong passion for what this medium can be and still is to this day. And I think he just, I just really kind of felt a very strong connection with him, because when you are invested in the public radio philosophy and mission, it's not hard to find kindred spirits after just a few moments of conversation. And so Bill is a tremendous asset, I think, to the system. And I think that he still tries to contribute to this day one way or another.
Well, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. I wanted to ask you about your Native American heritage, because as I understand it, oral history plays an important role in tribal traditions, right?
It does. Oral narrative is a very important part of our history and culture. In fact, before colonization happened and brought in things like publishing and broadcasting, oral narrative was just a way for our people. I'm a member of the Nez Perce tribe, or Namipu, as we call ourselves. Oral narrative was simply a way of communicating values, history, important life lessons, mythology, everything that was essential to the culture from one generation to the next. And so oftentimes, especially during winter, people would hunker down for the long cold season and gather by fires and share a lot of oral narrative between themselves. And that was especially true between elders and young people, because being authentic and accurate and conveying that information to an audience really does speak to my role today as a journalist. I think it fits in perfectly with broadcast journalism.
Let's hear another audio clip, and this one is from your interview with Jay Kernis. Can you set this up?
Sure. Jay Kernes began his earliest years with National Public Radio working to get Morning Edition launched in November of 1979. And it was a challenge for him because at that time, I believe All Things Considered had been on air for roughly 8 years. And there was always still at this point, you have to remember that NPR was still largely in its infancy. There was still kind of a scarcity of resources for money and studios and personnel. And so even though there had been some vested interest in creating Morning Edition, there was still a fair amount of resistance from other NPR staffers who were fairly hesitant to support it.
The rest of the news division was very suspicious about this new morning show, that we would take staff and resources away from All Things Considered. And Susan and Cokie and others were not happy about that. They basically pulled the wagons in a circle and said, you know what? We're really not going to help them much in the first year. And as the show got more and more successful and more stations signed up, those same people helped us get on the air. But as you can imagine, that first year was quite tough, 1979 and into 1980. The pilots had not been good, and people at NPR held back. Now, if you ask, well, why didn't the bosses just say to these people, well, we need you to be on the show, we're talking about Nina, Cokie, Linda, and others, the founding mothers. You really just didn't tell them what to do.
Brian, it sounds like NPR had strong, nurturing mothers.
You did not cross the founding mothers of NPR, no. It's a great clip, and I think it really speaks to the influence that these four women had at NPR. They were pioneers, they were innovators, they were largely the voice and face of NPR, especially in those early formative years. And so if you couldn't sway the founding mothers, you weren't going to compel them either at the same time. I think it speaks, though, to Jay Kernes's persistence and vision and support that Morning Edition became a flagship program a few years later. But, you know, I think it speaks, too, to the fits and starts that a lot of early NPR programs and initiatives had, that we listen today to these programs and we think they're just so seamless and so beautifully coordinated. But yeah, there was a lot of chaos behind the scenes, and maybe there's still a little bit of chaos behind it to this day. But being the absolute professionals that they are, you can tell that from just listening to NPR's programming 24/7.
Well, they helped build the trust and the integrity in the NPR family and with its audience.
Absolutely. And, you know, you said JPR, but I think it also speaks to the two-sidedness of this agreement, this working relationship, that NPR provides amazing programs and in-depth news coverage and a sensible, reasonable voice of authenticity in this loud din of, I don't know what you call it necessarily, this very angry, divisive political landscape that we have these days. But news stations, member stations like JPR, KLCC, our partners to the north, OPB, you know, it took a while for member stations to kind of get on board with this. But I've talked to many people at NPR through the years, and they say that a lot of our strength comes from member stations like yours, Mike, that produce programming like this program here, and that it instills that trust and relationship with local audiences. NPR, you know, carries things from the national scale, but programs like this and member stations like yours, JPR, I mean, are part of that essential chain of trust and authenticity. So, yeah, I don't think anyone should cut the member stations short, too. That it's a two-way street, and member stations largely, I think, do a great job representing the NPR mission and sound.
Well, you're very kind. My guest is Brian Bull. He's a public radio news reporter for KLCC in Eugene, and he's the lead interviewer for the Public Radio Oral History Project. We have another audio clip from your interviews, Brian. This one with Barbara Cochran. Can you set it up?
Sure. Barbara Cochran was hired on back in 1979 to become its news director. And it was interesting because this was at the time when they were trying to kind of put the polishing touches on Morning Edition that we just heard from Jay Kernis. And she talks about trying to get these operations going and trying to get news coverage coordinated, and at the same time trying to get this new program called Morning Edition launched.
When I walked in the door, there was no staff. There was no name for the program. But Jay Kernis, who later went on to be the senior producer of Morning Edition, came into my office. He had a huge reel-to-reel machine in my office. He put these two tape reels up there and played for me the Morning Edition theme, which had been composed by BJ Lederman, I think in his garage. And it was perfect. You know, you could just almost envision the sun coming up when you listen to that music. It was a great way to start a morning show. And so I thought, okay, well, we've got theme music. Now we just need the rest of the program to get together.
Were you part of the creative process that eventually settled on Morning Edition? I was curious how and when it finally got its namesake.
I think we had a sort of a contest. I initially favored the title playing on All Things Considered, First Things First, but I was persuaded that maybe that was a little too tricky and maybe a little too cute. And so Morning Edition, which kind of gave the idea of, you know, serious news, a newspaper told you it was a morning show, that seemed like the right title. So that was what we adopted.
I love hearing the background. That I didn't know these backstories.
Yeah. That's been kind of the sweet spot of doing a lot of these interviews, is that we sometimes go through the slog of some of the early formative documents and meetings, but you get these little gems that pop up periodically of just how the sausage is made. And Barbara relayed just that great anecdote of Jay Kernis hauling in this reel-to-reel. I don't know how many of our listeners know what a reel-to-reel machine is. Again, I'm dating myself, but the fact that we have these huge appliances and cut reel-to-reel tape with razor blades and use grease pencils, and now it's all digital, kind of just talks to you about just the early materials that we had back then. We were making fire with flint and steel and all these crude increments today. But back then, we just made do with what we had, and it was magic all the way through.
So how are these interviews being made available to the public?
Well, we're not ready to unroll them all yet, but I've been talking to KLCC about getting a website set up through klcc.org, and I would like to eventually start uploading transcripts and recordings of these interviews. We also had an arrangement with the University of Maryland, College Park, and they actually have a large repository of many things related to the formation of NPR, PBS, CPB's operations through the decades. And I plan on eventually submitting a repository of all these interviews to them when we get just enough to send over. In fact, I think they have some audio cassettes, probably about 40 of them from Washington State University from a different project that was done in the 70s with a number of member stations. And so I hope someday, maybe in the next year, to start getting these interviews uploaded to klcc.org. And at some point, too, maybe get a more of a curated interactive website designed through the University of Oregon, which has been helpful in getting a number of these interviews conducted.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this segment. But thank you so much for the work you're doing, Brian.
Well, thanks for having me on, Mike. I'm always happy to come on, and best to you in the station.